Dmitri sent two guards to fetch bread from the palace kitchen, and a telegram was dispatched to Nicholas in Mogilyev to ask what he would have them do. While they waited for a reply, Dmitri urged the kitchen staff to bake as much bread as they could for distribution to the crowd. What they would do if supplies ran out, he could not imagine. Perhaps by then some solution could be reached. The following day, Nicholas telephoned from the front and ordered the captain of the guards to suppress the demonstrations by force. He was incandescent with rage that the mob were scaring his sick children, and said the men should not hesitate to open fire. Dmitri felt sick to his stomach. Had the Tsar learned nothing from the revolution in 1905, when he had been forced to hand many of his powers to a newly created government body known as the Duma? His only option was to negotiate, because most of his army was at the front, and besides, he could no longer rely on the troops' loyalty. After the telephone call, the captain convened a meeting of the guard to pass on this order, and Dmitri knew from his colleague's grim expressions that it was useless. "I've had enough," one man said, laying down his weapon. "The army opened fire in St. Petersburg, and hundreds are lying dead in the streets. Me? I won't shoot my own people." A chorus of voices joined him, all in agreement. Dmitri and the captain remonstrated, but half-heartedly. They knew there was not enough manpower to hold back a determined mob, and any more casualties would only inflame tensions. The Tsar's orders would not be carried out. Every day brought news of further regiments that had mutinied. This revolution had been building for a long time, but now it had begun. No one knew what would happen next, or which direction it might take. It largely depended on Nicholas. If he was determined to try and shoot his way out of trouble, Dmitri feared the consequences, for him and for the country as a whole. He and his royal escort comrades patrolled the palace grounds with rifles and bayonets shouldered, ignoring the shouts of the crowd and the intermittent sounds of gunfire in the city. The snow was deep, and the temperature bitterly cold, but he marched with determination. No one would break into the palace where Tatiana lay while he was on hand to protect her. On the evening of the 28th of February, Alexandra came out into the courtyard to talk to the guard, swathed from head to toe in furs.
"For God's sake, I ask all of you not to let any blood be shed on our account," she pleaded.
Dmitri was shocked to see how much she had aged in a few days, her complexion pale as parchment.
"How are the Grand Duchesses, Your Imperial Highness?"
he ventured to ask. She shook her head.
"Not yet recovered. The chairman of the Duma has advised that we evacuate the palace, but the girls simply cannot be moved."
"You can count on us to remain at our posts," Dmitri promised. "No matter what." She pursed her lips and nodded her thanks, anxiety etched on her brow. Dmitri couldn't believe it when rumours began to spread on the 2nd of March that the Tsar had abdicated. It didn't ring true. Nicholas was too arrogant, too wedded to the idea of his divine right. At first it was said that he had stepped down in favour of Alexei, which seemed ridiculous given the boy's frailty and lack of experience. Next came word that Nicholas wanted his brother Michael to take the throne, but Michael had refused. Gradually, Dmitri realized the gossips must be right. Who would lead the nation now? Orders came that the guards' equipage were to vacate the palace, leaving officers of the royal escort as the only force guarding the perimeter. They rearranged their rotas and cut down on sleep so there would always appear to be enough guards on view to deter the mob from breaking in. It was a game of brinksmanship. As Dmitri marched by the railings, someone with a harmonica began to play the Marseillaise, the anthem written after the French Revolution of 1789. Dmitri's fingers tightened on his rifle. He felt like shooting that man on the spot. Everyone was jumpy, but none could have as much at stake as him, with his wife desperately ill inside the besieged palace. Still there was no word from Nicholas. He had promised to return to Tsarskoe Selo on the 1st of March, but the days dragged by without any sign. On the 5th of March, the telephone and electricity lines to the palace were cut, and food supplies were beginning to dwindle. When Dmitri rushed to the kitchen after an overnight shift to thaw his fingers and toes in front of the great ovens, the only food he could find was a tough loaf and some chicken bones from the day before. As he walked through the courtyard, charred scraps floated from the chimneys and drifted on the breeze like oversized black snowflakes. A colleague told him Alexandra was burning her correspondence and diaries. Why would she do that if she had nothing to hide? Dmitri could not help wondering what injudicious disclosures might have graced the pages of her letters to Rasputin. Better if they did not reach the hands of the new rulers, whoever they might prove to be. One scrap still had some legible words on the edges, and he ground it to dust beneath his heel. During the morning of the 8th of March, a delegation arrived from the provisional government. Dmitri recognized the politician Alexander Kerensky among them, and was faintly reassured. He had seemed a moderate influence in the Duma. They marched briskly into the palace, and were occupied inside for several hours. Dmitri watched the entrance, scarcely daring to breathe. Was Kerensky telling the family what their fate was to be? Was Tatiana well enough to attend the meeting? He glanced up at her bedroom, but the curtains were drawn. At noon, their captain called them for orders.
"We must leave the palace this afternoon," he said,
eyes downcast and the words sticking in his throat. There was a chorus of disbelief as he continued.
"The first rifles will replace us. They are in town this very moment, and you here imminently."
Dmitri felt sick to the pit of his stomach. The first rifles had vowed allegiance to the revolutionary government.
"The Tsarina asks that we go peacefully and refrain from any action that might delay the Tsar's arrival and affect the fate of her children."
He passed round some small jeweled icons of the Holy Mother that Alexandra had given him for all the men of the escort who had served so faithfully. Dmitri fingered his icon, fluttery panic in his chest. What should he do? He couldn't bear to leave the palace. It was insufferable to be so powerless. He considered hiding somewhere in the building so as to remain close to Tatiana, but knew he would be arrested if he were discovered. Instead, he sought Trina, the lady's maid, to ask for news of Tatiana's health. He hoped it might be possible to see her, to explain that he must leave, but would remain nearby.
"She still cannot receive visitors," Trina told him. "But I've been given a pass to get in and out of the palace. If you like, I can meet you and convey letters between you."
Dmitri arranged that he would meet her at a side entrance every morning. Then, with feet dragging, he went to his quarters, took off his Imperial Guard's uniform, and changed into civilian clothes, packed his knapsack, and wandered out into the grounds. He gazed up at Tatiana's window, willing her to look out. He yearned to see her, both to reassure her and to reassure himself. Who knew how long before they would be reunited, or under what circumstances? Walking out the palace gates and away from her felt wrong, as if he was wrenching off a limb. Chapter 18. Tsarskoe Selo, Russia, March 1917. The vitriol directed against the Romanovs in Tsarskoe Selo was staggering. Everywhere Dmitri went, townsfolk gossiped about Alexandra's supposed promiscuity, speculated that Alexei was not the Tsar's son, and even cast aspersions that the Grand Duchesses took lovers amongst the palace staff. It was hard not to lose his temper and lash out, but he restrained himself and occupied his time writing to old friends from the Imperial Guard, men such as Malevich, whom he knew would be loyal to the Romanovs. Surely together they could find a way to help them. In public, he was careful not to identify himself as a scion of the family, because the mood was so ugly he could have been attacked by a mob. He saw one aristocrat fleeing on foot after his carriage was overturned. Every day, Dmitri scanned the newspapers, trying to work out, like other Russians, who would be their new leader. Prince George Lvov seemed the current face of the provisional government, but a council in St. Petersburg, the Petrograd Soviet of Workers and Soldiers' Deputies, was increasingly influential, and more Soviets were springing up around the nation. The stridency of their pronouncements alarmed Dmitri. What Russia needed more than anything was a wise leader who could get food to the people and quell the urge to blame all the country's ills on one absurdly wealthy family. Tatiana was slowly recovering from her illness, and judging by her letters, seemed to have no idea of the danger the family faced.
"My dearest love, I wish we could meet, but but at the same time I am far too vain to allow you to see me like this. You will be shocked to learn that my remaining hair has been falling out in clumps, and I must wear a headscarf to cover the bald patches. I know how you loved my hair, and promise I will grow it again as soon as I can. I am also much thinner, but can eat solid food once more, and aim to gain weight very soon. We are all in reasonable spirits. I think we are going to sail to England for a holiday with our relatives, George the Fifth and his family, until the revolution is suppressed. We are waiting to be told when a ship will arrive to collect us. I miss my work in the hospital, but am occupying my time with reading and trying to stop the younger ones from arguing, a mammoth task. I miss you, and wish I could be with you even for just one moment to lean my forehead against yours and see if I can read your thoughts.
Dmitri was glad she could not read his thoughts, because he couldn't imagine how the British would simply send a ship through the Baltic, which was patrolled by German warships. Would Germany guarantee them safe passage? That would not go down well in revolutionary Russia. But in his reply, he did not mention his doubts. Now that your vanity has returned, I am reassured you will soon be yourself again. Once you sail for England, I will follow hot on your heels. Perhaps your parents will allow us to be officially wed there if the revolution is prolonged. We could buy a manor house in the countryside and keep horses and dogs. I will have to polish my English, which is nowhere near as fluent as yours, and adopt an accent that sounds like a man being strangled, such as their aristocrats use. But all in all, I think it a good plan. Every day he strolled up to the Alexander Palace to deliver a letter to Trina and receive the one Tatiana had written for him. Afterwards he walked along the road outside, hoping in vain for a glimpse of her. He often saw Tsar Nicholas cycling around on an old bicycle, wearing a workman's jacket and cap like a country peasant. Sometimes he was chopping wood or breaking ice, but always his head was down, and he did not notice Dmitri pass by. From the newspapers, he knew that Nicholas and Alexandra were under house arrest to prevent them trying to retake the throne, but to Dmitri's eyes, it did not look as if they had any such intention. The gates were patrolled by revolutionary guards, identifiable by their badges showing a factory worker carrying a red flag. Dmitri could tell they were inexperienced from the awkward way they held their fixed bayonets, and their jumpiness at any sudden noise. These were eager new recruits jumping on a bandwagon. Townspeople stopped to gawp through the fence, and one whispered to him that the guards would take you inside the grounds for a glimpse of the family for a fee of 20 rubles. Tatiana had not mentioned this in her letters, and the disrespect horrified him. It was as if they were exotic creatures in a zoo rather than monarchs from a centuries-old dynasty. Spring came, the snow and ice began to melt, and trees burst into leaf almost overnight. Every day he missed Tatiana more, and his fears for her increased. Why had nothing happened? Still there was no word of when the ship might arrive to take her family to England, and unable to bear the suspense, Dmitri made an appointment to visit the British ambassador, Sir George Buchanan, in St. Petersburg. He used his status as a member of the royal escort to gain admittance, which was risky, because identifying yourself as a Romanov acolyte was inadvisable in the current climate. It was better to be a worker. If anyone asked, Dmitri claimed to be a common soldier of lowly birth. Recently, his mother had written that his father had been questioned by revolutionary guards and told he might have to stand trial on charges that were not yet specified. How could a general who had earned so many medals for service to his country be under suspicion? Anyone wealthy or well-connected seemed to be a target. Many of the Romanovs' friends had been arrested. Anna Virabova, Alexandra's lady-in-waiting, was being held in the Peter and Paul fortress, and several members of the extended family were under house arrest in case they tried to help Nicholas regain his throne.
I am afraid that the British Foreign Secretary has recommended that the Russian government make some other plan for the future residence of their Imperial Majesties, Ambassador Buchanan told him, peering through half-spectacles. The difficulties of transporting them to London in wartime proved insurmountable. Besides, the new government are not keen for the Tsar and Tsarina to leave, since they are privy to so many of the country's war secrets. You understand, there is nothing more I can do.
Dmitri was horrified.
You must help. What will become of them without the aid of their British cousins? There are calls in the press for them to stand trial as traitors to their country. Who knows what might happen?
The man shifted in his seat.
We will, of course, continue to apply pressure and ask that they are treated with humanity, but as a rule, the British government tries not to interfere in the affairs of another sovereign nation.
Dmitri felt a clenching of his gut and a sense of dread that made his heart heavy as he left. If the British would not save them, then it was up to pro-monarchist Russians. He had located around 20 colleagues who promised to help, but that was nowhere near enough to launch an armed rescue attempt and spirit the Romanovs out of the country. The railway workers were a militant bunch who would never allow them onto a train, and they had no hope of stealing a ship from the heavily guarded harbour. Besides, he remembered what had happened to Louis XVI of France and his wife Marie Antoinette after they tried to slip out of France in 1791 following the revolution there. They'd been intercepted, tried as traitors, and beheaded. He shivered. If the Tsar and Tsarina were being accused of betraying their country, then it was important not to give the prosecutors any ammunition. He did not tell Tatiana of his discovery, but he could sense from her letters that her mood was darkening.
The doctor tells us that Olga's heart has been weakened by the measles, and Maria still cannot walk. I do my best to cheer the invalids by reading aloud to them, and in fair weather we take them out in wheelchairs to the formal gardens. We are allowed to wander deep into the wood, where it is quite wild. I avoid coming round the front of the house where people stare at us through the fence, but I would do so if I thought I would one day see your dear face there. We have occasional visitors, but I do not wish you to become known to our revolutionary captors, or else you might end up in prison, like poor dear Anna Virabova. How could they do that to a cripple? What treason could she possibly have committed? Oh, Dmitri, I yearn for you with my entire soul. If we could have but 5 minutes alone, the thought of your passionate nature and fine mind, your sparkling eyes and strong arms, make me feel I can cope with anything so long as I am assured we will be together again some day soon.
Dmitri was encouraged to hear they were allowed to wander into the wood, and it occurred to him that perhaps there was a chance he could meet her there. He borrowed a horse and rode around the edges of the palace grounds, looking for less well-defended points. He was able to make his way into Alexander Park through the graveyard for imperial horses, and rode on past the farm to the woods, searching for a place where he might meet Tatiana. There was a Gothic white tower just 5 minutes from the front entrance of the palace, a place where servants used to sleep. It did not appear to be in use any more, so he slipped inside and climbed the winding staircase to the 6th floor, then walked out onto the turreted battlements. He could see across the park all the way to town.
Would the guards let Tatiana walk that far? It was a short distance from the formal gardens.
Perhaps she could try. Rather than put his message into a letter, which might be intercepted, Dmitri asked Trina to tell Tatiana he would wait in the White Tower at 10 o'clock each morning. If she was able to join him for a few minutes, that would be wonderful, but he emphasized that she should not dream of putting herself in danger. The next morning he got there at 9:30, hiding just inside the entrance to the tower, in a spot where he could look along the path Tatiana would have to take. He did not have long to wait before he saw her strolling past the lake, stopping to pick wildflowers and placing them in a basket she carried over her arm. She was very thin, in a grey gown with a grey scarf tied over her head. Dmitri admired her elegant walk. She looked like a grand duchess, even in peasant-style clothing. She bent by the water's edge to pluck a white iris, checked the coast was clear, then scurried across to the tower's entrance. In an instant, Dmitri pulled her into his arms and covered her face, her dear mouth, with kisses.
"Oh, my love,"
he breathed, but was unable to say any more. She still looked ill, her complexion pale and her cheeks hollow, but there were no scars from the measles rash. He stroked her cheek with his finger and looked deep into her grey eyes, overwhelmed by the strength of his emotions.
"I cannot stay long in case they miss me," she whispered. "But it is wonderful to see you."
"How are things in the palace?" Dmitri asked. "Tell me the truth."
She hesitated.
"It's full of drunken soldiers, smashing our precious belongings and carousing till all hours.
There does not appear to be any discipline. Papa seems resigned to it, and wanders round on his own without talking to any of us. Mama has taken to her bedchamber, where she works on her embroidery. I am the one who must raise everyone's spirits, and sometimes I confess it takes more energy than I can summon. But being here, with you, has revived me.
I will be here every day at 10, and I am doing my best to secure your release.
If only the British would hurry,
she sighed. Dmitri looked away. He couldn't bear to be the one to tell her the British were no longer planning to rescue them. Instead, he asked how she passed her days.
Papa and I are planting carrots and summer vegetables in a plot near the palace. I enjoy working with the soil, although my nails are suffering.
She held out her hands to show him, and he kissed each palm in turn.
And you? What are you doing?
I have lodgings in town where I await news from the various quarters I am talking to about your rescue. But I often wonder if I should tell the new government of our marriage so I can be detained with you and stay by your side.
No! She cried. You mustn't. We need you outside. If you joined us, you would be unable to help.
She kissed his lips.
I love that you would be willing to give up your own freedom, and of course it would be wonderful to see you every day. But for now, it must be this way.
Perhaps we can see each other more often. I will come to the tower every morning, and you should join me whenever it seems safe. Don't take any risks, though. They had one last lingering kiss before she turned to walk back into captivity with only a quick final glance. As she disappeared round the corner of the palace, it flashed into Dmitri's head that this might be the last time he ever saw her, and the pain was like a stab wound. He couldn't bear her to be in danger. He yearned to snatch her and ride off into the countryside, just keep riding till they reached safety. But she would never leave her family. That wasn't an option. A few days later, Tatiana came to the tower again, and every few days after that, a spring turned to full-blown summer. The meeting sustained them. She was able to unburden herself, and Dmitri could revel in the sheer exhilaration of being with her. Afterwards, he relived every embrace, every tender word, and felt warmed by the certain knowledge of her love. On the 12th of July, he was waiting in the White Tower when he saw her approach just as two revolutionary guards appeared from the other direction, their routes set to intersect. Dmitri could sense Tatiana's confusion as she tried to decide what to do, and he willed her to turn back, but it was too late.
"Oi! Who are you?"
one of them called out. Dmitri couldn't hear her response, but it seemed she told the truth, because the soldier replied,
"Your lot aren't allowed over here. You shouldn't be outside the palace courtyard. Get back right now, whore."
Rage filled Dmitri with a red-hot fire. He had a knife in his belt, and he was pretty sure he could kill the two of them before they were able to raise the alarm. Tatiana glanced quickly in his direction, shook her head almost imperceptibly, then turned and hurried back along the path to the palace. Dmitri was still shaking with rage that they should speak to her so insultingly. He watched closely as the men passed, memorizing their faces, vowing that when the revolution was overthrown, he would have them jailed. When he rode round to the side gate to meet Trina, she had a hurried letter from Tatiana.
"I was so sad not to be able to hold you earlier today, but in my daydreams I am pretending those soldiers did not stop me, and we were together. I try to fill my head with joyful images, and I wish you would do the same. I am sorry to say that we may not have another opportunity to meet at the tower, because we were told this morning that we are leaving Tsarskoe Selo on the 31st of July. They have not said where we will be taken, only that we are heading south, so we hope the destination is Nevadia. How wonderful that would be. We will take as much as we can, because who knows when we will return. Anyhow, my dearest one, I will write as soon as I know our destination, in the fervent hope that I will see you there before too long. I love you with all my heart, now and always."
Dmitri made sure to position himself near the gates of the Alexander Palace from dawn on the 31st. It seemed word of the family's move had leaked out, because there were hundreds of people there, some of them jeering and calling names, others just come to gawp. The disrespect made him very cross,
although he understood the desperation of the thousands upon thousands of starving families whose male breadwinner had been killed in the war. He saw an official emerge with a message for the guards, and wormed his way close enough to hear that the royal party was being taken out of the west gate of the park, on their way to the railway station. He leapt on his horse and rode at speed to intercept them, arriving at the station just as they were disembarking from a convoy of shiny automobiles. His eyes sought Tatiana amidst the throng, and found her at the exact same moment as she spotted him. He touched his fingers to his lips, and blew her a discreet kiss, and she did the same, then folded her hands as if in prayer. Seconds later, she had stepped up into a carriage and disappeared. He felt an enveloping sense of emptiness in his core, and a foreboding deep within his bones.
Chapter 19. Lake Akanabi, New York State, the 12th of August 2016. A violent storm swept across the lake one night, and the rain woke Kitty at 4 in the morning, sounding like stones hurled from the heavens as it pelted on the tin roof. She lit her oil lamp and went to the door to watch. Trees were bending sideways in the wind, lightning forked across the lake, and her fire pit had already filled with water. At least there didn't appear to be any leaks in the walls she had patched. The howling of the storm and the clattering on the roof were so loud she couldn't get back to sleep. So she opened her great-grandfather's second novel, Exile. Bob had brought all the novels round a few days earlier, neatly inscribed to him and his wife, Sue. Exile had originally been published in 1927, but this was an American reprint dated 1950. The writing was beautifully lyrical, but the story was bleak. It told of a man who had been forced to leave his homeland for reasons that are never explained. He arrived in a bright city full of corruption, where everyone was trying to sell something, drugs, useless modern gadgets, or themselves. She wondered if this was how Dimitri saw New York, then remembered he had not arrived there till 1934. Maybe he was writing about Berlin. The man in the story is haunted by some wrong he has committed in the past. He falls in love with a beautiful woman, but is unable to commit to their affair because of the damage to his soul, and in the end, she leaves him. One thing was for sure, Kitty thought, rubbing her eyes, this man understood depression. She'd never read a book that took you so deeply inside the head of a depressive, and it was a disturbing experience, which was somehow mirrored by the cataclysmic weather. Dawn was breaking outside with a faint pink glow, but still the rain hammered down, bouncing off the sun-parched ground, and the opposite shore of the lake was obscured by low-hanging cloud. Even at 8 o'clock, it was still so dark that Kitty needed to use her lamp for reading. She decided to drive to the vacation park coffee house for a latte and some human company. The novel had put her in a gloomy, introspective mood. Jeff wasn't there, but the coffee house was full of campers sheltering from the elements. Kitty found a corner and plugged in her laptop to charge, listening to the complaints of the holidaymakers who had hoped to go hiking, canoeing or rafting, and instead found themselves with long hours to fill and squabbling children to entertain. The windows misted up with their breath, and the loud babble made Kitty feel desperately lonely and, for the first time, homesick. No one paid her any attention as she opened her laptop. First she went to the Guardian website and read about the news back home and the issues that were concerning Guardian readers, government cuts, immigration, the usual stuff. Her cursor hovered over her email icon, and steeling herself, she clicked to open it. 1,875 emails were waiting, she was told, and she sipped her latte as they began to flash into her inbox. Tom's name was prominent among them. The name Tom Fisher, Tom Fisher, Tom Fisher, flashed past her eyes like strobe lighting, and her chest felt tight. Whatever he had to say, she wasn't ready to hear it. But she couldn't help noticing the email headings. I'm so sorry. Please get in touch. Urgent. I need to speak to you. I will always love you. Please can we talk? She let her eye skim down the list, but didn't open any of them. There was a pain in her chest, beneath the ribs on her left side, a hard rock that nagged like a tumour. She tried taking a deep breath and letting it out slowly, but the pain persisted. She put her hand over her heart and felt it beating more rapidly than usual, and that made her panic. She couldn't breathe. Kitty yanked the plug from the wall and closed the laptop. Tucking it beneath her arm, she squeezed past the huddle of campers, stepping over backpacks and small children to reach the exit. There was a yell of communal protest when she opened the door, letting in a gust of rain. So she stepped out into the squall and closed it quickly behind her. She got behind the wheel of the car and pulled out of the car park, but her heart was hammering too fast, and her breathing was too jagged for her to drive. After a few hundred yards, she pulled into the roadside and bent forward, resting her head on the steering wheel. What did it mean? Was Tom saying, "I will always love you, but I love Karen as well. I will always love you, but I want a divorce." What kind of love was he talking about exactly? A month had gone by since that morning when she checked the messages on his mobile phone, but she wasn't ready to hear from Tom yet. That much was obvious. She had been foolish to open the email account. It would take more time before she was able to deal with that situation and all its repercussions. It merely underlined her sense that her marriage had failed, that she had failed. In her head, she heard her mother's voice berating her. "Why, you such a quitter? You take piano lessons, then get bored. You start tennis coaching, then don't want to go back. You never stick at anything." Was it true that she was a quitter? She had stopped piano and tennis and drama and all those other extracurricular activities because her mum had such high expectations. She had to be a prodigy at everything. When she rang home with the news she'd got a 2-1 in her journalism degree, her mum had commented, "What a shame. If only you'd done a bit more work." She could just imagine the deep sighs if her mum could see her now, hunched over a steering wheel, her heart overbeating with anxiety. She forced herself to breathe regularly, counting to 5 between breaths and trying to make her mind go blank of everything but the in-breath and the out-breath, as they taught at her yoga class. A truck sped past with a whoosh, covering her windscreen with a wave of surface water. She knew she needed to keep herself occupied, and reading Dimitri's next novel was not going to hack it. Then she remembered the overgrown patch of weeds behind the cabin that she'd been waiting for the right moment to deal with. It should be easier to uproot them now the earth was softened by rain. She'd get soaked to the skin, but it would give her a real sense of achievement to clear that patch. It was flat and treeless, so maybe she could do some planting there. Keeping busy was the best way to cope with a broken heart. Chapter 20. The rain continued all week, but at least it was still hot. Kitty spent her time clearing the earth around the cabin, and it was like working under a power shower, as the torrents beat down on her back and steam rose from the freshly dug earth. It was tough work that left her streaked in mud, with muscles that ached in new places every day. She used her camping stove to heat noodles and make tea indoors, and spent the evening sitting in her swing seat on the covered porch, drinking wine and reading Dmitri Yakovlevich's remaining novels. They were rich and in some ways surprisingly modern stories, with an overriding theme of love and loss. His male characters were more in touch with their emotions than any man she knew, endlessly analysing their reactions to events. But his women were all slightly idealised, a little too perfect, maybe. Could any male writer create convincing female characters? She wondered. The last two novels, the ones written in America, could easily have been published in the present day. The writing was clean and spare, but evoked glorious images that filled her head until she felt she knew the people in his stories as well as if they were her companions in the cabin. They were complex and flawed, but never dull. Was that what Dmitri was like? Kitty remembered that she held the copyright to these novels as part of the inheritance. She should try to get them reissued. Perhaps she would contact his last publisher, Random House, and ask if they might be interested. She could imagine them selling well with modern covers and intelligent broadsheet reviews. She could write a feature about her great-grandfather and explain how she came upon his story, but she would have to find out more about him first. He was still a shadowy figure with a biography that consisted of a few dates and places, and huge gaps in between. One afternoon, when the rain was coming down in sheets, she heard a car pulling down the track towards her cabin, and she dropped her spade to watch. It was a police car with two officers inside. One of them opened his window and called out, "You Kitty Fisher?" She was astonished, and before she answered yes, her mind had invented a dozen different reasons why they might be there. Had she breached her car rental agreement? Was there a problem with the ownership of the cabin? Did she owe local taxes for something?
"Your husband reported you as a missing person back in England," the closest officer explained. "They tracked you down from your credit card use, and the vacation park told us you were here. Is everything okay, ma'am?"
It had never occurred to her that Tom would call the police. What an idiot. "I'm so sorry you've had to come out all this way," she gasped. "Please, come in for coffee and I'll explain." They followed her to the cabin door, carefully wiping their feet before entering. Kitty lit the gas stove. "I'm sorry, I only have one chair," she told them. "You're my first guests. I've been here a month doing up the cabin. I recently inherited it."
"You didn't tell your husband you were coming."
One of the policemen did the talking, while the other wandered round, examining the work she'd done patching the walls. She turned away to spoon instant coffee into cups. "I decided I needed a break. He'd been cheating on me."
"So you're teaching him a lesson?"
"No," Kitty shook her head. "I couldn't decide what to do, and I wanted to see if I could rescue this cabin, so it fell into place."
"Looks like you've done a good job here, but you should let your husband know you're safe. He thought you might have done something stupid."
Kitty frowned. "You mean suicide? Tom knows me better than that." Her voice trailed off. Did he? Could he really have believed she might have killed herself over Karen with a double R? That implied a level of arrogance she hadn't thought him capable of.
"He's gone to a lot of trouble to find you, so he must be pretty torn up."
Kitty considered this. Tom was torn up. Well, good. But still she couldn't face talking to him and listening to all the pathetic excuses he was bound to come up with. "I don't suppose you could pass on a message that I'm safe, and that I'm staying here for the rest of the summer? But please don't give him the address. I don't want him turning up."
"Why? Is he violent?"
"No," she said quickly. "It's not that." They looked at each other, and the talkative one pursed his lips before replying,
"You're awfully isolated out here. You sure you don't want him to visit?"
She tried to picture Tom at the cabin, but it felt wrong. The cabin was hers, not his. And as her panic attack the other day showed, she wasn't ready to talk to him. Not yet. She was acting instinctively, protecting herself from further pain. And when she felt strong enough, she would get in touch. "I'll call him, but not yet. I apologize for taking up your time. I'm sure you've got far more important things to do."
"No, ma'am. It's pretty quiet out here. The odd car accident, a few DUIs. We're not a crime hotspot. If you're sure that's what you want, we'll email the police back in England and tell them you're fine. Thanks for the coffee."
They looked around for somewhere to put their cups. Kitty smiled and took them. The officers paused for a moment, peering out the cabin door, waiting for a lull in which to dash to the car without getting soaked. But no let-up appeared to be on the way.
"Keep safe, ma'am,"
they called, as they ran out into the downpour. She waved from the porch, then came indoors, and sat on the bedding roll, hugging her knees to her chest and rocking back and forth. How stupid Tom was. He'd be lucky not to get charged with wasting police time. He must have guessed where she'd gone before they tracked her credit card use. He just hated the fact that he couldn't control this situation. In a flash of insight, Kitty realized they had slipped into a pattern in which Tom always made the decisions in the marriage. Perhaps it was because he was the one with the regular salary. He decided which holidays they could afford, or when they needed new cars. He had wanted to move to Crouch End, a smart, middle-class area, even though it meant all the profit she had made on property developing, as well as her inheritance from her parents, was swallowed up. She would have been quite happy staying in the multicultural whirl of Turnpike Lane, but Tom thought the crime rate was going up, and the final straw came when his car window was smashed in an attempted theft. It hadn't been like that in the early days, when money was scarce. Holidays had been spur of the moment, and they never booked package tours, simply got a cheap flight to Bangkok or Mumbai and travelled around by local transport, finding basic accommodation in beach huts or rooms in villages where tourists were a rarity. Suddenly, she remembered the delicious smell of the fresh tea growing in the mountains of southern India, where they had stayed in a tiny hostel. They'd hiked in the hills by day and sat outside in the dusk eating mango and chatting with local people who passed on their way home from the fields. She remembered the day Tom saved her life by throwing a well-placed stone when a black snake appeared on the grass beside where she was sitting. She remembered the scent of the garland of white jasmine he bought from a street seller for a few pennies and placed around her neck. She remembered how they used to talk and talk and never run out of conversation, endlessly fascinated to hear each other's point of view. What had happened to that? Something in Dmitri Yakovlevich's last novel came into her head. A male character ponders why his relationship is so different 20 years down the line. The dynamic has changed, the power base has shifted, and he realizes that as his own position in life has changed, it has skewed the way he views his partner. Kitty mused on this. Tom was not a dictator. She had let him drift into becoming the one who took responsibility for mortgages, cars, and holidays. He hadn't taken the power. She had given it up. She didn't like making decisions of that sort, because she found them stressful. It was easier not to take the risk of what her mother deemed failure, and by default had slipped into a role that was almost like that of a child. It was an interesting theory, and the more she thought about it, the more true she realized it was. She had been coasting along, not being a full partner in the marriage. Perhaps Tom would have liked her to pull her weight more. Of course, none of this excused the fact that he had been unfaithful to her. She was still furious when she thought about that. Was she punishing him with her silence? Probably. But the main obstacle was that when she thought about calling or even emailing him, she began to feel panicky. It brought up such a host of anxieties about money, security, family, what she was doing with her life, that she had to shut the lid on the box quickly and busy herself with something else.
Chapter 21. Tobolsk, Siberia, the 6th of August, 1917.
Malama, sweetheart. We have arrived in Tobolsk after a long journey by train and then steamer. How remote and strange this countryside is, flat and marshy, with swarms of insects and wide open skies. I am told it is only possible to reach here in the summer months, because as soon as winter sets in, the river freezes and no traffic can get in or out. Perhaps this is why they chose to send us here, shut away and forgotten, where Papa can cause no political problems for the new government. We are staying on the steamer for now, because the governor's house, where we are to be accommodated, was recently used as a barracks and is in desperate need of cleaning and refitting. We are able to walk around the town, and I have found the people curious but friendly. Everyone asks why we girls have short hair, thinking it is some new fashion in St. Petersburg, and they don't know what to say when I tell them the real reason, that we have been ill. I will mail this letter quickly in the hope that you will come to join us in this little hamlet. I wish I could say more to recommend it, but as you know, we will make the most of it. I require little to make me happy, merely to know that my family, and that includes you, are safe and well. Tenderest love from your T.
The letter reached Dmitri in Tsarskoe Selo 2 weeks later, and he went straight to Malevich's lodgings. Rather than reveal the truth, he told him he had heard from some contacts about the Romanovs' latest location.
Why Siberia? Dmitri worried.
It's the landlocked dead center of the country. They obviously don't plan to send the family overseas any time soon.
I suspect they don't know what to do now the British have refused to take them. But why couldn't they go to Denmark, where Nicholas's mother hails from?
If the government won't do it, then we must try to get them there. I will travel to Tobolsk, look at the lie of the land, and see what can be done. Malevich agreed.
And I'll stay in St. Petersburg and find comrades prepared to help. We can communicate by telegram. But be careful what you say, because there is no doubt it will be read by the new power-crazed authorities. Let's pretend to be businessmen and refer to the family as cargo.
Dmitri flinched.
Yes, I know it's insensitive, but needs must.
The thought of a Siberian winter filled Dmitri with gloom, but he packed a bag with snowshoes and his wolfskin coat and hat, and set off for the long journey to Tobolsk by train and then river steamer. His only consolation was that each mile brought him a mile closer to his beloved wife. As he walked up from the docks on the Irtysh River, the skies were leaden, although the temperature was sweltering. He asked directions to the governor's house, assuming their family would be installed there now, and was directed to a square, white building of two stories in the classical style, with a courtyard around it bordered by a 10-foot fence. A couple of guards stood by the gate. There was no sign of the family, but he caught a glimpse of movement by a first-floor window that made his heart lurch. Was that Tatiana? If only she would glance out. He ached to see her. Dmitri hung around until the guards were beginning to eye him with suspicion, whereupon he wandered round a corner and was overjoyed to encounter Trina, the lady's maid, coming up the hill with a basket.
"Thank goodness you're here," he cried. "I've just arrived. Are the family well?"
"As well as can be expected," she told him. "The Tsar is frustrated by the lack of space for outdoor activity. You can walk round that yard in 3 minutes or less, and there's nowhere he can plant his vegetables. The Tsarina has made a chapel in the old ballroom and prays there daily, but otherwise keeps to her bedchamber. And the girls and Alexei are bored. They're only allowed into the yard between 11 and 12, and then from 2 until dusk."
"Are you able to pass letters to Tatiana? The guards don't search you."
She nodded.
"Of course. I'm staying in a house down the hill, so walk up here every morning at 7:30, and I often come up and down on errands."
"I'll bring you a letter each day at 7:30.
Bless you for your loyalty."
He clasped his hands together. What would he do without Trina as a conduit? She must have guessed they were lovers, but had been utterly discreet.
"If you like, I'll ask Grand Duchess Tatiana to come out onto the balcony and wave to you," she offered.
"Is that safe? Won't the guards notice?"
"The girls often sit on the balcony and watch people go by. Come at 1:45.
At 1:40, Dmitri walked up the hill, trying to appear as if he was strolling casually. From afar, he could see the silhouette of Tatiana on the balcony. She was taller, more slender than her sisters, and she held her head high, almost like a ballet dancer. As if she felt his gaze, she turned and saw him, and they stood for a few moments watching each other from afar. It was intensely moving for Dmitri. To know she was safe, to see it with his own eyes, was overwhelming, and he realized that throughout the journey to Tobolsk, he had been afraid of arriving to find her dead. The example of the king and queen guillotined after the French Revolution was stuck in his head. On the one hand, he was sure no loyal Russians would kill their imperial family, but this spirit of revolution that had been unleashed was volatile and unpredictable. The guards did not appear to be watching, so Dmitri sauntered along the road bordering the garden, glancing up whenever he thought it safe. Tatiana touched her fingers to her lips, then clasped her hands to her heart. He wanted to walk past again, but a guard turned to watch him, so he crossed the road as if he had just remembered some errand. If he were careful, he would be able to catch a glimpse of Tatiana every day. That was something to look forward to. Goodness knows what these guards would do if their marriage was revealed. He would probably be arrested on the spot. The letter Trina gave him the next morning detailed a little of life inside the house, and no matter how hard Tatiana tried to be positive, Dmitri could tell she was miserable.
"Malama, sweetheart, I thank you from the bottom of my heart for following us to this remote place. We have done our best to make a comfortable home, with all the photographs and knick-knacks we brought from Tsarsko Selo, but the lack of freedom weighs heavily. Most of all, I miss being able to walk in the woods and meet you inside the tower. It seems no such thing will be possible here. Did you know Dostoevsky was briefly imprisoned in this town in 1850? I often wonder what he made of it. Our days are spent reading, playing bezique or dominoes, exercising in the yard, praying or eating meals, and the time drags interminably. I look at the clock, thinking an hour must have gone by, and realize it is only minutes. We have one light on the horizon. We have been given permission to attend Blagoveschensky Church this Sunday, the first church service we have attended in 6 months,
so all are very excited. Perhaps you could be there too. I would love that. I know you will never abandon me, but all the same, do not think I am unappreciative of the sacrifice you have made in following me here, and the possible danger it could mean for you. I love you for it. I love everything about you. My sole happiness lies in daydreaming about a future in which we are together.
Dmitri made sure he was in the church well before the service, on a side from which he could survey the rest of the worshippers. To his surprise, the royal party were led in through a side door, which meant they had to pass directly in front of him. Tsar Nicholas was lost in thought, but the Tsarina gave a slight nod of acknowledgement. Tatiana gave a quick smile, while Olga looked astonished as she glanced from him to Tatiana. Her sister obviously hadn't mentioned that he was in town. He watched Tatiana as she crossed herself, then lit a candle. She was wearing a cornflower blue dress with a high neck, and her short hair was arranged in fetching waves, almost reaching her shoulders. She looked solemn as she stood alongside her mother and sisters, but as soon as the singing began, she joined in, and she turned to catch eyes with Dmitri several times. Orthodox services were always long, but this priest seemed determined to impress his royal visitors with his stamina as 1 hour stretched to two. Dmitri would have liked him to preach all day, just so he could stand and watch his beloved. It was wonderful to be under the same roof as her after weeks of separation, and to see for himself that she was healthy. At the end, the family walked in front of him once more, and Tatiana let her hand brush his arm as she passed. Dmitri had rented lodgings in town, and that evening he sat and wrote to Malevich, telling him of the situation in which he had found the Romanovs, the cargo. He described the layout of the town and the position of the guards around the house, but really he knew rescue from this place was impossible. Already, in early September, the temperature was dropping rapidly, and in just a few weeks they would be unable to leave Tobolsk for the 8 months of winter. Perhaps the following spring the revolutionary government would relent and allow the youngest family members to go free. No one could possibly think them guilty of any crime, no matter what the sins of their parents. Dmitri felt furious with both of them for their blinkered, outdated approach to monarchy. The Romanovs had made their vast fortune from the resources of the nation, yet Nicholas had not seen fit to open the coffers when his people were starving. Alexandra had been remarkably short-sighted in using Rasputin as an advisor when she was seen by ordinary Russians as allied to the enemy. Between them, they had turned the once revered imperial family into a hated institution. But the children were so young. Alexei only 13, Tatiana only 20. Surely they could not be blamed. Yet again he thought of poor Marie Antoinette, the French queen, whose only crime was to have been born Austrian in an era when Austria was France's bitter enemy. Her eldest daughter, Marie-Thérèse, had been held prisoner for 6 years before being released into exile. Would Alexandra's German roots and Nicholas's imperious style yet count against them all? Could an accident of birth mean years under house arrest for the younger Romanovs? Chapter 22. Tobolsk, Siberia, Winter 1917. On the 28th of October, Dmitri bought his usual newspaper from a street seller and recoiled as he read the headlines. There had been yet another coup in St. Petersburg. 3 days earlier, Bolshevik leader Vladimir Lenin and his comrade Leon Trotsky had led a successful coup against the provisional government in St. Petersburg. It had begun at 9:45 p.m. with the battleship Aurora firing shots at the Winter Palace, and ended at 2 a.m. with the taking of the palace by rebels. The provisional government had been imprisoned in the Peter and Paul fortress. Dmitri was stunned. Both Lenin and Trotsky were lunatic extremists who had been forced into exile after the 1905 revolution. When Lenin arrived back in Russia in April 1917, everyone expected him to join the provisional government, but instead he published his own radical agenda in Pravda. He believed peasants should seize land from rich landlords, that factory workers should take over the factories, and that manual workers should receive higher wages than office workers. Everyone Dmitri knew dismissed Lenin as mad. No one thought he could possibly succeed. Yet somehow he had. The change had come over the summer, when Lenin announced his intention of withdrawing Russia from the war with Germany without delay.
While the provisional government tarried, pressing for better terms, Lenin promised battle-weary soldiers that they could come home immediately, and finally they had switched allegiance. It was a short-term measure that would cost the country dear, almost certainly losing them control of the Baltic states. Dmitri wondered what would become of his parents, back home in the comfortable estate that had been in his father's family for centuries. What would happen to the Romanovs in the new workers' paradise? Dmitri realized straight away that these events would split Russia down the middle and change the country he loved forever. Shortly after the coup, a letter came from his mother telling him his father had been arrested. It seemed the Bolsheviks were taking a hard line with what they called the bourgeoisie. Dmitri worried that his proud father would not submit easily to captivity, and prayed he would not be foolish enough to resist his captors. He wrote to his mother and instructed her to engage a good lawyer. In other circumstances, he would have ridden home to protect his mother and sisters and to agitate for his father's release from prison, but for the time being, his first loyalty must be with his wife. He wondered if news of the Bolshevik coup had reached Tsar Nicholas, and asked Tatiana in his daily letter, but it seemed from her reply that she did not appreciate the implications of the change of government. "I am glad the war is over if it means no more Russians will be killed. But Papa is worried that the Baltic lands currently occupied by the Germans may be lost in the peace negotiations. He has requested that he might be included in the discussions." After that, she changed the subject. "Did I tell you we are now keeping 5 pigs in an old stable in the yard? They are very sweet, and come when called, like dogs. Ortipo barks at them, but is too much of a coward to venture close. I must not let myself become over-fond of them, as I suspect they are intended for our table this winter. We also have chickens, turkeys, and ducks, and Father has dug a duck pond for them. I have begun to reread the works of Tolstoy, since it seems we are stuck here for the next few months. I'd forgotten what a great storyteller he is. Do you like Anna Karenina? We are also rehearsing a production of Chekhov's 3 Sisters to entertain our parents. I am the director, and play the role of Masha. I only wish you could come to watch." Dmitri was astonished by Tatiana's everyday tone. Did she realize that the nation was rift in two? He supposed that in captivity her horizons had narrowed. Either that, or she was putting a remarkably brave face on events. He thought he had grown to know her rather well, but found it impossible to guess what she was thinking deep down. Was she simply being cheerful for his sake? Dmitri wrote to several aristocrat friends asking what they planned to do about this so-called workers' revolution. Surely they wouldn't give up their property without a struggle. It was agony to be stuck in Tobolsk, powerless to help resist the coup. But he couldn't leave Tatiana when every day he felt the danger increasing, like a dark shadow sweeping across the land, set to envelop them completely.
"The 20th of December, 1917. Malama, sweetheart. The temperature today is -19, and the windows are draughty, so I am huddled in my warmest coat and shawl, and have tempted Ortipo to sit on my lap, where she acts like a hot water bottle. Still, my freezing fingers make it hard to hold the pen, so forgive me if my writing is shaky. We are occupied with making Christmas presents, since we cannot buy them. I am painting bookmarks to give to all our guards here, and embroidering or knitting gifts for the family. What can I make for you, my dearest? Would you like a scarf or some socks? Be sure you are in church for the Christmas Day service so we can see each other. I do love Christmas. As I write, my nostrils are full of the citrusy scent of a balsamic fir Christmas tree that stands just outside my bedroom door."
Dmitri was in his usual place in Blagoveschensky Church for the Christmas Day service. These brief occasions when he could be in close proximity to his beloved were like a balm to his anxious soul. The Romanov family arrived, huddled in their coats and mufflers, and Tatiana had a smile in her eyes as she passed him and pushed a tightly wrapped parcel into his hands. No one noticed in the bustle of worshippers, and he quickly secreted it inside his coat. He had earlier given Trina his Christmas present for Tatiana, an amethyst brooch he had purchased from his landlord's wife, and as she unfastened her coat, he could see that she wore it on her collar. She turned and caught his eye. The Christmas service was interminable. It was conducted by a new priest, and when he called out the names of those taking communion, he used the old, forbidden title, Tsar Nicholas II, Emperor and Autocrat of all Russias. A gasp went around the church, and the guards standing by the doors glanced at each other. This priest obviously did not know that monarchy had been abolished.